You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of October, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, chewing over some of the past fortnight's construction industry news. And maybe we should start today's discussion, Phil, with a review of Labour's first 100 days in government. That's what people tend to do. The first 100 days is the sort of watershed, isn't it? And they've been up to a few tricks, haven't they, where the construction industry is concerned, or rather they haven't been up to any tricks.
Yes. Hello. Morning, David. Morning, everyone. Well, I think the way into this subject is to follow up our last episode, our last discussion. We talked about the Lerb Thames crossing and saying that the decision was due, but we didn't think it would be taken. We thought it would be a holding decision at best. Well, in fact, the decision was delayed. The development consent order application was supposed to be made on Friday, the 8th of October, whenever it was, and that's been put back to May next year, I think, is the...
Yes, it is May, yeah.
The postponement on that. And that's not the only big decision that's been deferred on infrastructure projects. There's a £280 million Anglian Water wastewater treatment plant in Cambridge. Decision was meant to be made on that by the environment environment, food, rural affairs, DEFRA secretary the other day, and that's been pushed back as well to January, that one. And it turns out that 40% of these decisions, 4 out of 10, have been deferred. And we've talked before about how the government, you know, they've got huge ambitions. They're the builders, not the blockers, and they want to build gazillions of houses. Well, they want gazillions of houses to be built. They're not going to build any houses, as I said before. But what they can do, what they do, maybe not the water sector, that's privatised, but they do build infrastructure, which the country needs to pave the way for housing and so on and so forth. And they're dodging this. And I don't understand how they can present themselves as, you know, paving the way for the big build and economic recovery if they're dodging, delaying, deferring difficult infrastructure decisions. And when they're not dodging, they're scrapping, like, you know, the Stonehenge Tunnel we talked about.
Yeah.
So it's not a good look. And it was made worse by the publication this week of a green paper, a consultation paper, called Invest 2035, the UK's Modern Industrial Strategy, which you would think set out an industrial strategy. But it doesn't, really. I mean, I must confess, I've only spent half an hour with this document over the past couple of days, 66 pages of it. And all it's doing is it sets out what the problems are that we've got and how the country's been underperforming and where it's been underperforming. And it sets out the government's, you know, lovely, lovely aspirations that they, you know, let's have a look at the executive summary. I mean, it just talks about we're going to deliver the certainty and stability that businesses need to invest. And we're going to, you know, sustainability and everything's going to be great. And we're going to be pro-business and ambitious and it's all going to be fabulous. But it doesn't really, what actually is the whole list of questions. You know, what do you think? And so it's hoping for businesses and unions. It's also inviting very much front and centre and anyone who knows anything to come forward and come up with this. And what they've done in conjunction with this is, I mean, they say they are setting up an industrial strategy council. But that ain't new. We've had an industrial strategy council before. In 2017, it was set up and it was scrapped in 2021-2022. So obviously that didn't do a great deal. So it's a little bit same old, same old. So what's got the construction industry particularly upset is that construction is not even mentioned in this industrial strategy. They've picked, is it 8 industrial sectors, broad industrial sectors? I mean, not even manufacturing, but advanced manufacturing, which I think we know what that is, but I couldn't begin to give you a definition of what advanced manufacturing is. Clean energy, creative industries, which I suppose is everything from authors to you know, pop music to filmmaker, and filmmaker is a big one. Film studios.
Yes, of course.
Defence, digital technologies, financial services, life sciences, professional and business services. Now, it's interesting. I saw a comment from the RIBA, the architects, and they seem to be saying, this is great. We love this because we're part of the creative industries. I would have thought they're more professional and business services than creative industries.
I would have thought so.
More ally themselves there. You can claim both.
They like to think of themselves as artists, though, Phil. That's why they wear black polo neck sweaters. they're artists.
I thought they wore red corduroy trousers.
Oh, well, they used to.
Anyway, so that's what's going on there. I mean, what's your take on it all?
Well, I agree with you that there's a lot of talk and not an awful lot of detail. The thing which worries me, I suppose, is that there's a lot of aspiration, but not much explanation. You know, they talk about what they want to do, and they don't provide many hints as to how they propose to go about it. I mean, you mentioned that infrastructure, of course, is vital to support housing developments. You can't build a housing development in the middle of nowhere without roads leading to it or drains leading away from it and water treatment works and all the rest of it. You've got to put in the infrastructure. So that is worrying, because if they don't, you know, if they don't build the infrastructure, then the housing which they are apparently committed to won't get built either. And I'm not sure I really buy the argument for delaying decisions on major projects such as the, you know, the Lower Thames Crossing and this water treatment works in Cambridgeshire, because they've been around for a long time. I mean, we're always talking about the Lower Thames Crossing. It's not as if it's something that Rachel Reeves or Louise Hague, the Transport Minister, is unlikely to have familiarised themselves with. They must be all over it, surely. They must have been for months, if not years, familiarising themselves with this. Why do they need to delay the decision?
It's possible that the delaying it till next May, it's possible that's a smokescreen, and we're going to have a big announcement in the budget. Maybe we've got the budget in 2 weeks' time, 2 weeks today,
yes,
if that happens. At least that's what it's scheduled for. And it could be that there's going to be massive infrastructure announcements then, and we're going to go, yay, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. If there are, as I said before, the Lower Thames Crossing, it won't be saying we're going ahead. It'll be saying how we intend to go ahead. It might say we're going ahead. But there's work to be done, I think, on that before we can actually start putting, in terms of the funding arrangements,
yes,
before we start putting spades in the ground. So it could be that these things are just being stockpiled for for the good news in the budget, because, as we know, the budget's going to have some horrible news in it about tax rises.
And, well, that's right.
U-turns.
Well, yeah, this £22 billion black hole, which the Labour Party has been banging on about ever since they got into power. That's now, I heard on the radio, I think this morning, that's now £40 billion, this black hole. I don't know quite how it's got so much bigger. And I just wonder if, you know, they're going to shelve all these massive infrastructure projects because they simply can't afford to build them, because there's this black hole that they need to fill first. I mean, I don't know if, I haven't looked into it, but I think people are saying that this is what's going to be mentioned in the budget. And there has been speculation about a big infrastructure announcement in the budget, but nobody seems to have any information on that. It's all rumour at the moment.
On the subject of government strategy, though, what they're doing, I had a very interesting press release that Homes England put out. Homes England is a government agency which, its raison d'etre, it exists as the to be the lender of last resort for primarily housing, hence the name Homes, house building projects, which are perhaps slightly not quite viable So it wants to get things off the ground, and it's been very involved in a lot of these big developments, like North Stowe comes to mind, and I think the one down your way, the big Newtown thing, is I think Homes England's involved in that, isn't it?
Yes, can't remember the name of it, down in South Devon somewhere, yeah.
And it does a lot of good work, but it's also lent money to turkeys, to some of the prefab builders that have gone belly up, and it's lost money there. But it's basically an organisation that lends our money. Now, an announcement yesterday is that it has invested, not lent, invested 50 million quid into Schroders Capital Real Estate Impact Fund. Schroders, big, I assume they're American, big bank, and they've got a real estate impact fund. And the word here is impact. In other words, it's for real estate projects which are touchy-feely nice and can have a social impact, somehow suggesting that not all houses have a social impact, which I thought it would have. But anyway, it's the big push. It, it's nice and lefty, cuddly-feely. And so Homes England is not lending this bank 50 million quid, because banks don't need to borrow money from the government, or shouldn't do, unless they're, RBS of a few years ago, needing bailing out. But the government's investing in it, which I can only think it thinks this is a good punt with government money. We're going to get a return on it. So I emailed Homes England this morning. I said, I thought Homes England was a lending organisation rather than an investing organisation. Speculating by lending rather than speculating by investing. You might say it's a moot point, what's the difference? But there is a difference. I haven't lent, it's not with Legal & General anymore, but I didn't lend Legal & General some money for my pension. I invested some money into a Legal & General pension fund all those years ago. So there is a difference. And I said, is this now a change in... remit, scope of Homes England, a change in its function, a change in its way of operating? And the answer came back, what's your deadline? When do you need to know? So I haven't
another
heard
decision
back,
delayed
that yet. So I've said, as soon as you can, please. So it'd be interesting to find out whether they are going to be investing in other things, buying shares in Vistage.
Yes, we'll come on to that.
Now Vistage's share price is nice and low. It's come down. Good opportunity to buy Vistage shares on the cheap. The government might want to do that. But then, of course, we'll have Barrett saying, well, why aren't you buying our shares? We're a much better bet.
Well, it's... I suppose, I'd like to say, I was about to say all will be revealed in a fortnight's time when the budget is announced. I doubt that all will be revealed, but quite a lot might be revealed. At the moment, I mean, the government, let's not forget, has actually got off to a fairly rocky start, with all the, Lord Alley and all the rest of it, and the favours and donations and stuff like that. The overall impression isn't a particularly good one. So it does worry me that the government perhaps doesn't really know what it's doing or what it should be doing. If they made a few really incisive decisions, that they did make huge play of wanting to build, 1.5 million new homes within the first 5 years or the next 5 years before the election, and was one of their key selling points. And since they've got in,
and every day,
I was going to say, since they've actually got into power, they don't seem to have done much at all except kick the can down the road. So it bruises my confidence, I have to say.
Well, every day, the way I see it is, every day they duck important decisions and they don't do something positive and dynamic is another day that the newspapers are full of Taylor Swift visits and meetings and things and spectacles and frocks and flim flam frippery frappery instead of the real stuff of government, which they should be doing. The upshot was, of course, the departure of Sue Gray, the chief of staff, who was meant to be the grown up in the room. Who knew about government and was once described, even under the Tories, as the person who really runs the country. So we'll see what the rejig of the number 10 behind the scenes stuff, what difference that makes. But at the moment, it does all seem to be. There's a wonderful new phrase I discovered from the Times this morning. You mentioned Lord Ali. Fockers. Do you know what Fockers are?
Well,
friends of Keir.
Oh, no, okay. I've never heard
friends
of that
of
one.
Friends of Keir. They're Fockers.
I thought it was a German aircraft manufacturer. Oh, friends of Keir. Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Fockers and Spads. So I've got to get my acronyms up to speed here. so we'll have to look out for those. Oh, well. So got another 2 weeks of indecision, presumably, until we actually get some answers.
I think so.
You mentioned Fistry, Phil.
I did.
Which is our second topic of this morning. Now, this is an interesting story because not so much. I don't really understand finance. It's all a little bit goes over the top of my head. But they've had a bit of a blow to their share price. I mean, Vistry being one of the top house builders in the country, their share price took a tumble recently. And the reasons behind it are, I think, quite interesting. Do you want to fill us in? Because you wrote the story.
Well, they put out a trading update on 8th of October last week, saying that they had just discovered that, some of their developments in the 9 out of their 46 developments in its South Division, they'd understated the costs by about 10%, the build costs of 10%. And that was going to dent their profits by £80 million this year, plus a further £30 million next year, and £5 million in the financial year after that. So, £115 million costing error. They've changed, which I think we'd say sacked. They've made changes to the management team in that division, and they've begun an independent review to fully ascertain the causes. And the market reacted badly. I mean, Vistry has been a very strong performer in recent years. Interesting company in many ways. It used to be its roots are in Bovis, and then Bovis merged with Linden, effectively acquired Linden Homes, the house building arm of Galliford Try, and then they acquired Countryside Partnerships.
This was all quite recently, wasn't it? I mean, within the last two to 4 years.
Yeah. And subsequent to the acquisition of Countryside, I can't remember this year or last year, but really recently, they announced a strategy shift that they were going to stop the traditional business of speculative development of housing, where you buy some land, put up an estate, put up sale signs, open a show home, and Johnny Public comes around and going, I'll have that one, please. And instead getting into partnership house building, which is where they get up front, find a buyer, normally a housing association or a local authority, and say, do you want a block of flats here? We're going to build a block of flats here. Do you want this? They go, oh, yes, please. And therefore, and that model is a lot lower risk because you've sold it already before you even started it. It's less capital intensive. It's safer, but it's lower margin. And this year haven't explained why they got their build costs wrong on these 9 developments. There has been widely reported speculation of 2 potential reasons. One is that they'd failed to factor in inflation. And we have had in the past year, in the financial year that this year we've been talking about, build cost and inflation of 20% or more, depending on the products you're talking about. But huge inflation. It seems amazing they'd get that wrong, but that's possible. And another suggestion was the failure of a groundworks contractor. I'm not sure who that was, but some groundworks contractor went out of business, and that might have costed them more to get over that speed bump than they thought, or it had been an unanticipated speed bump. There's also a suggestion that if it's happened there, it might have happened somewhere, on other sites too.
Well, Vistry have said that they're confident that this mistake was confined to their southern region division. But as you say, people have said, well, can we believe that? There was one analyst said, it was an analyst or I think actually a financial journalist who wrote in one of the investment journals that Vistria's reputation has been dealt a severe blow as a result of the news, and that such a basic mistake is unforgivable. So I think that gives you a flavour of the sort of reaction that the market's had to this announcement. You know, if they did forget or omit to factor in inflation, then that really is schoolboy error, isn't it?
Well, this is the there's a Times piece that they've quoted some industry insider, don't know who it was, it wasn't me, Gov, that they found the getting the costs wrong, the underpricing error on Friday, and on Tuesday morning, they say it's just in this area. And they've got 300 sites around the country. Mm. And they're saying it's just on these 9 sites out of 300. And it says, how can they be so sure that they've reviewed or, you know, they've trusted if it's just a quick weekend audit? Mm. So there's a little bit of fear that there might be more bad news down there.
Because I suppose the mistake might have been made locally, but you know, it got all the way through to the top, didn't it? Without being picked up, somebody would have pointed out, you know, where's the calculation for inflation? But nobody saw that. I quite like the idea of this sort of a partnerships approach. I think it has a lot of merit. Not necessarily, I'm not talking from the business point of view. I mean, you've just outlined, why it might be beneficial from a business point of view because of the certainty. You've got a buyer and all the rest of it. And if you do get your calculations right, then it's probably good. But it is a good, I think it's a good way of providing affordable homes and countryside properties, partnerships. It was all about affordable homes, wasn't it? We hear a lot about affordable homes. You know, you get your local builder will be knocking out, 25 houses on a plot somewhere, of which 5 of them will be affordable. But we all know that affordable doesn't really mean anything. They're cheaper because they're smaller and they're pokier. But I think as a way of providing genuinely affordable homes, to local authorities or to housing associations, it's quite a good. Quite a good model. It's just a shame that they seem to have come unstuck here, I suppose. I mean, as you pointed out, the thing about the way speculative house building works in this country is that you build the homes and then you sell them. So that if during the process of building your costs have gone up, your materials prices and your employment, labour costs have gone up, you just add that onto the price at the end of the day, and that's the price that the house buyer pays. But you can't do that with this model because you agree the price up front.
I would imagine, I don't know this, I'm shooting from the hip here, but I imagine it ought to be cheaper to build on the partnership model because you can just get on and build it, whereas if you've got a big 300 unit suburban site, mm-hmm. they tend to sort of build it in phases. We'll build the show home and the first cul-de-sac or whatever.
Yeah,
and once you start, sell a bit, build a bit more. And it takes some years to develop. Now, if you can just build it all at once without waiting for bits to sell before you start building the next phase, that's got to be cheaper, I would have thought. Because
I would have thought so too.
Keep rolling it on.
But also the speculative model, you've got to spend an awful lot on sales and marketing, haven't you? Which presumably you wouldn't have to do if you with this partnership model. You just do one negotiation right at the outset, and then once your partner has signed on the dotted line, off you go. You don't have to worry about marketing suites and expensive advertising campaigns, that kind of thing. So I think it probably is a good model if it's handled correctly. It just sounds as if somebody cocked up here and the mistake wasn't picked up further up the line.
Well, I think the other thing that makes investors, potential investors, some, slightly wary of Vistry, is the fact that Greg Fitzgerald, the chief executive, is also the chairman, executive chairman. He has both jobs, which is, it's not against the rules, but it's against the sort of city codes, the accepted, you know, corporate governance, governance best practice. And if Vistry come out of this one fine, smelling of roses and sort it all out, it'll be no problem. But if things get worse, it's going to put, I think, pressure on Greg Fitzgerald to pick a job.
I mean, I don't. What's the difference between the two roles? I mean, an executive chairman, I suppose, is obviously hands-on, being an executive chairman and a non-exec. But chief executive, executive chairman, how different are the roles?
Well, in a publicly listed company, a stock market listed company, the chairman, generally speaking, is not executive. He is non-executive.
Yeah.
You know, he turns up, might work very hard behind the scenes, but you probably don't necessarily see him. He's not visiting sites except for, you know, red letter days and whatever. But he's there to represent the shareholders. The non-executive directors on the board are there to represent shareholder interests.
Right.
Which very often means the big, financial institutions, pension funds and these sort of things. The chief executive is there to run the business. So the non-executive, the chairman is when it works, is the sort of the elder statesperson.
He's the House of Lords, presumably.
We've kept talking about chairman. Well, in this context, he is a man, but chair, we have to be, modern world chair. The chair is, the House of Lords example is, or perhaps a better example would be government and House of Commons. The House of Commons doesn't run the country, but it's there to keep the government honest or try to. But yeah, it's more advisory, guidance, avuncular, consultory. What's the art version of avuncular?
No idea.
I'm trying to come up with the gender-neutral version of avuncular.
Well, okay. No, I can see there's a potential sort of conflict of interest there, or a lack of, I don't know, moderation, perhaps. If the chap's wearing two hats, then maybe you're right. He does need to choose one job and let somebody else do the other one.
I mean, if it's your own company, go ahead and do it. I mean,
sure.
a lot of most family businesses is just the head of the family. Their business, they run it. But you will see private companies like, people like Waits and Wilmot Dixon and the big private companies, they seek to follow the corporate governance codes and often have a non-executive chair who is perhaps a former chief executive, perhaps one of the family members, but not always. We saw this at Lange O'Rourke. I mean, Ray O'Rourke moved up from, he brought in a chief executive and then he became chairman. And then that, I think he reversed that on and off. I'm not quite sure where we are now, but he's been back in the seat as chief executive and chairman.
And I
can't remember where we are now with Lange O'Rourke. But if it's a private company, it doesn't matter. It's his train set, he can do what he wants.
Well, interesting to see what happens with this. As you say, there's been an awful lot of comment in the financial press about this. Most of it, as I said earlier, is lost on me because I don't know the ins and outs of it. I don't know how these things work, but it's clearly shaken up the investors and had a huge impact. I was quite surprised actually, because it's not unusual for a construction firm particularly, to issue a profit warning, for example. It's never good news, but it doesn't seem to generate quite so much interest, let's say, as this has done. I think it's maybe because it looks as if there might be something beneath the surface going on, or there might be there might be something else going on. I don't know. But
I think that's the fear of it. There's no evidence for that, but it's all about confidence, isn't it, investors?
Yes. Right. Well, I'm talking about other financial performances. There's been a quite a big plant hire has announced some difficulties, financial difficulties, would you say? An interesting change of tack for this company, which is Ardent Hire Solutions, their name. Company which was set up, how long ago? About three or four years ago.
Merger of 2015, Ardent.
Oh, was it? Oh, right. Blimey, 9 years ago. Okay, that was the merger of Fork Rent and One Call Hire, wasn't it?
That's right. And Steve Corcoran, the former Speedy chief executive. I'm not sure to what extent he was the architect behind the whole thing, or to what extent he was just the lead guitarist slash lead singer, because it's a sort of a private equity deal to bring these two. So whether it's money people saying, who's the best man for the job, let's get Corcoran, or whether Corcoran went to the money men saying, I've got a great idea of my, you know, big last hit. Fork Rent, as their name suggests, was a telehandler specialist. I think they were the biggest telehandler fleet in the country at the time.
They were, yes.
And One Call Hire was a general plant company. And they came together. But yeah, that's the origins of Ardent. So tell us what's happened since, David.
Well, they've, as you say, Fork Rent had this focus on telehandlers, and telehandlers are, you know, ubiquitous. You'll see them on every site. They did extremely well. Fork Rent was a very successful company. It grew very quickly. One Call was a sort of a general plant hire, a bit like a smaller version of what used to be called A Plant and is now Sunbelt Rentals, I guess, you know, sort of small. Relatively small, non-operated plant. And the two businesses, I suppose, were complementary. You know, they put them together and it works. It's worked particularly well. But they've just published their results for their financial results for the year to March 2024, which shows a 7% fall in turnover from 75.1 million down to 70 million. This year, but profits have fallen even further. I mean, they're down to 2.8 million from 8.2 million last year. So that's quite something. And apparently, this is all caused by a restructuring which the company has initiated at the beginning of this year. Phil, can you explain why that's happened?
I think so. I mean, I've read the annual report, the accounts of Ardent Hire Solutions, and I hadn't known before reading it that they were going through a restructuring. First of all, I should say context, £2.8 million pre-tax profit on 70 million turnover is a perfectly healthy business that contractors you can only dream of. So we're not suggesting that the fall in profits from 8.2 to 2.8 is disaster for Ardent. I mean, the costs that they've had to bear this year as part of their strategy shift. What's interesting is the strategy shift that they're going through, because, as you said, they started off as a coming together of telehandlers and general plant, and they're now selling off their general plant, all the stuff which was kind of the One Call Hire kind of stuff, excavators, rollers, compactors and dumpers. They are gradually selling off. It'd be a bad business to get rid of them all at once, so they've been doing it gradually. During the financial year that these accounts talk about, the year to 31st March 2024, the fleet size reduced by 14%. They got rid of about 700 or so machines net, because obviously they're always buying new machines as well, because it's the whole process of running a rental business is buying and selling. Age profile, right? But what it's been buying new is telehandlers. So if we go back to the origins of Ardent in 2015, it had about 5,000 machines, half of which were telehandlers, 2,500 telehandlers, and the other half were, you know, excavators, rollers, dumpers, and, you know, that kind of earth moving stuff. But at the start, by January this year, it had 2,400 telehandlers, so roughly the same sort of telehandler size fleet, and 2,000 earth moving machines and access platforms. As of last month, 1,400 of those have gone, and all 2,000 will be gone by the end of the year. So by the end of this year, Earth Moving Machines access platforms will have gone. I'm not sure where the access platforms came in, whether one called Hire had access platforms or whether there's been an acquisition in the meantime on that side of things. I'm not sure.
No, I don't know.
The story on that one. But they're basically effectively becoming Falkland again.
Yes. I mean, that is interesting because, as I said earlier, I keep calling them forklifts. A lot of people call them forklifts, but telehandlers are, you know, very much a sort of workhorse of house building sites particularly, but lots of other sites as well. Very, very successful piece of machinery. But then so are dumpers and mini excavators and compactors and stuff like that. You know, you'll find those on every site as well. So it seems odd to me that Ardent feels that it has no need of those anymore. I think you suggested actually when we talked about this yesterday that it might simply be a question of oversupply or saturation of the market.
There's clearly something going on in the market. It can't be a coincidence that Nixon Hire, who have been, you know, the past couple of years, that have been downgrading their earth moving side of their business. And I think it was a year ago or 2 years ago, we reported that they were keeping their earth moving fleet at their home base up in the northeast, but at their other bases around the country, we're going to use the cross hiring model. If any customers of theirs wanted a dumper truck, they would hire it from someone else. They would be the middleman for that.
Yes,
and then they've got, and at that time they said, we are not withdrawing from earth moving. We are simply, you know, doing a little bit
focusing on site accommodation, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Site accommodation and lights, power, mobile office, yeah, toilets. But they've now actually got rid of the earth moving-y stuff, the general plant in the northeast as well. So it's they've kind of completed the move that they started last year. Even though they initially said that last year's move wasn't a first step towards where they are now. So it's
Well, they didn't want to frighten the horses, I assume. They just said they're going to let it happen gradually. But yeah, that is it. It is interesting that they've decided to get out. Are they similar size to Arden?
I think they might be a bit bigger. They're 100 million turnover in 2023 with Nixon Nears, damn it. And about 77 million of that was hire and service.
Right.
So that puts them a little bit bigger than Arden, but you know, similar ballpark.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, the biggest plant hire, of course, in the country is still Sunbelt. Maybe they are so dominant that there's no room for anybody else offering that kind of equipment. I mean, Sunbelt are everywhere, and I think they've been fairly acquisitive, haven't they, in recent years? Bought up a few of the regional hirers. Maybe it just makes it more difficult for other people offering site dumpers, mini excavators, that kind of thing, to compete with them.
I suppose everyone's looking for an edge, to specialise. And maybe if it's too general, you just get lost. But I'd be interested to know why that general unoperated plant hire side of things, because certainly there doesn't seem to be a similar sort of activity amongst the larger, you know, operated plant, the sort of the Flannerys and Lynch's type of people. They seem to be doing okay with the big projects that they're involved in.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of equipment that Ardent, you know, aside from the telehandlers, that sort of small non-operated plant, as I say, is on every site. You'll find it on virtually every site. So there's definitely demand out there. It's just whether or not the supply, you know, there's oversupply. I mean, that's the only explanation I can see.
I tell you who we ought to have on. The people who are quite good at knowing what's going on in the market are the people like Euro Auctions and Ritchie Brothers, the auction houses.
Oh, people who sell all the second-hand stuff.
Yeah, they see exactly what's coming through and what prices are doing. And if, you know, if the resale price of a, you know, whatever, a five-year-old mini excavator has gone down, then, you know, that tells you that there's oversupply. Or if all the buyers are from overseas, that tells you there's oversupply in the UK.
Yeah.
So that'd be a...
Oh, well, maybe we should do that. And if anybody has any insight on that topic, maybe they should email us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk and let us know about that. But, yeah, interesting.
Talking about emails to us, we had a follow-up email from our last episode. We somehow found ourselves talking about anagrams.
Didn't we? Yes.
In the context of Kohler, the engine people's rebranding to, what do they call themselves? Arcola? What are Kohler now?
Oh.
Anyway, I was explaining this story to my wife. So you've heard of Kohler? I said, no, the drink. I went, no, K-O-H-L-E-R. You must have seen it on Sally in the Kitchen. Suddenly realised it's on our kitchen sink.
No, really? They literally make kitchen sinks.
every time, well, clearly she doesn't do the washing up often enough. It's obviously my job. I'd forgotten or hadn't taken on board. Anyway, we're talking about anagrams in the context of Kohler.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what we suggested. But, we had Bryce Bosier of JCB has been in touch.
He's an engineer there, isn't he?
He's obviously... this came over the weekend. We should tell this to JCB. He's not been doing this in working hours. It's obviously definitely arrived for the weekend. And here some of my favourite ones came with Galliford Try, our Philly dog art. Balfour Beatty is a tearful bat boy.
That's a good one.
Or a flatboat buyer. Morgan Sindel, a bit unpleasant. Anal mould rings.
Oh, no, that's not very nice at all.
You're not going to bleep that. You can't bleep that.
No. No, I think that goes through.
I think the listeners at this point should be informed that our producer has just halted proceedings to debate whether he should be allowed anal mould rings to get into the podcast or whether he should be bleeping it out.
Well, I think they're going to get in twice now, Phil.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
Lang O'Rourke, our Anglo-Kier, talking about Fockers and friends of Kier's, our Anglo-Kier is Lang O'Rourke.
Ah.
Robert McAlpine, Britain's ale crimper. Unfortunately, they're not a brewer.
They're a building company, yeah. Okay. He's certainly been busy, hasn't he, Bryce?
This is one. He says, working at JCB, obviously I looked at our competitor, and discovered that Caterpillar is literal crap.
No, that's priceless. Not for Caterpillar, of course.
And this probably also might trouble our producer. The construction index he looked at, and apparently that's Durex contents itch.
I think you should bleep that one out for sure.
We'll see.
Anyway... That's enough anagrams, Phil.
Okie dokie. Right. I have nothing else up my sleeve. Anything else you want to talk about, David?
There's nothing else I am qualified to talk about, Phil. I think that's it.
But according to our plans, we will be back not on Wednesday, but on the Thursday of the budget week, because we want to be able to talk about the budget after it's happened rather than when Rachel Reeves is talking. It'll be the first ever budget speech delivered by a woman. Which would be interesting.
I think she'd be drinking whiskey.
That makes it interesting.
Are they still allowed to do that, chancellors? Are they allowed to drink whiskey while they deliver their speech?
I think so. They haven't done it for a while. I don't know who the last one was. I think Ken Clark used to do it.
Yeah.
Rishi drank Mexican Coke Cola, I think was his thing. Sorry if he drank it in the house, but that was his tipple of choice. We'll be talking
about that.
The Thursday, the day after the budget, with our trying to get our heads around what it may or may not all mean for the construction industry. And we're fingers crossed for some big infrastructure announcements, because Lordy, we need them.
Absolutely.
All right. Okay. On that note, thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.